Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, I talked to legendary filmmaker Joel Berlinger about his new crime series for Netflix, Crime Scene: The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. Mark Royal takes a look at Tom Hanks doing a Western in the news of the world and the much talked about promising young woman. Plus, Lord Mayor of Dublin, Hazel Chu, chats to me about her favourite movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. On this Valentine's weekend, I hope you're loved up as best you can be. Now, take a quick listen to this.
You can act like a man! What's the matter with you? Is this how you turn out a Hollywood Pinocchio that cries like a woman? What can I do? What can I do? What is that nonsense? Ridiculous. You spend time with your family?
Sure I do.
Good. Because a man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man. You look terrible. What should they eat? I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's gonna give you what you want.
It's too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
That's a clip from The Godfather, of course. Marlon Brando, you can act like a man. Why am I playing that? Well, why not? You know, just play The Godfather all day. What's the problem with that? But I was reading about a new movie by Barry Levinson, the great director of things like Rain Man, Barry Levinson, whose son, Sam Levinson, was on the show last week for Malcolm and Marie. But here's a movie coming out all about the making of The Godfather. It was formerly known as Francis and The Godfather. And it's all about Francis Coppola's struggle to get The Godfather made. So it was a shoot that was beset by all sorts of problems. The studio didn't want Brando. They didn't want Al Pacino. The mob were getting involved. It was kind of chaos. And Levinson is doing a movie all about this, which I think is going to be great. Elizabeth Moss, Oscar Isaac, and Jake Gyllenhaal are going to be in it. So if there's any man who can tell a great story, it's Barry Levinson. So telling the story of The Godfather, I think it's in safe hands. So I'm looking forward to that whenever that sees the light of day. Now, a lot of people in touch, as they are every week, and I had mentioned previously that someone had recommended that I should watch Night of the Demon, a horror movie from the late 50s. Someone else was in touch. Pat texted in saying, "Hi John, Night of the Demon is a superb film. Do check it out." So that's two recommendations I've had for it now. I read once this Buddhist idea that if someone tells you something three times, you should definitely do it. So if someone else tells me to watch Night of the Demon, I will definitely do it in the coming week, I promise. That idea that if someone tells you something three times, you should do it, doesn't always work out. I found myself on a stage in a dank pub one night telling jokes because someone told me I should on three separate occasions. Didn't work out well. Anyway, let's move on. In TV this week, I was watching this.
What do you think people imagine when they picture the Cecil Hotel?
Is there a room here that maybe somebody hasn't died in? I never got used to that. Never got used to that.
Throughout its history, the Hotel Cecil has always had a dark persona.
People call it Hotel Death.
This was a place where serial killers let their hair down, like Richard Ramirez, who had come back covered in blood, and no one's got a problem with that.
Now, that was a clip from the new Netflix four-parter Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. And it's a four-parter all about a strange hotel in LA, in a really rough part of LA called Skid Row, called the Cecil Hotel, where all sorts of bizarre things have happened, like serial killers have stayed there. murders have taken place. It seems like a pretty godforsaken place. And this documentary is looking at that, but more specifically, a particular case and a vanishing of a young Canadian traveller called Elisa Lam, who disappeared from there in 2013. She travelled all the way down from Vancouver and was kind of on a travelling sojourn. And she disappeared, and footage of her last appearance in the hotel, very scary footage, CCTV footage of her in a lift with a door opening and closing, possibly talking to someone, appeared. And it appeared on the internet, and there was a lot of armchair sleuths who went trying to investigate this missing Elisa Lam. Now, this has all been turned into, as I say, a four-parter by the great Joel Berlinger, who gave us stuff like the Ted Bundy tapes. He also made a movie about Ted Bundy. He gave us the Metallica documentary, Some Kind of Monster. He was a guy who kind of pioneered this whole true crime, wrongful conviction genre back in the 90s with a series of movies called Paradise Lost, all about these three guys who were wrongly convicted of a supposed satanic murder in the States in the 90s. So he's, you know, people trace his work back to, you know, starting things like Making a Murderer and all that kind of thing. So anyway, I got to talk to the great Joe Berlinger this week about Crime Scene, The Vanishing, The Cecil Hotel, and a lot more besides. Joe, you know, sometimes you're occasionally called, you know, the godfather of this whole area and stuff like that. I'm wondering, the idea that you were picking a location this time as your way into a story, the Cecil Hotel, obviously, in the first one, does that put a different spin on things for you? Did it mix things up for you in a positive way?
Yeah, you know, over the years, I've done a lot of crime, obviously. And every time I do a story, I wonder, you know, what is it about South Boston that produced a particular kind of you know, gangster? You know, I made a film about Whitey Bulger. I don't know if people in Ireland know who Whitey Bulger is, but they should.
We do. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, what is it about that time period and geography, about that place, South Boston, that created a certain type of criminal? What is it about the Pacific Northwest that helped create and allowed a Ted Bundy to flourish? So, you know, I've toyed with these ideas while I've made these films, but I've never really deeply leaned into a location and dissected a location, almost, you know, because I have found that locations can be almost like an accomplice to the crime, the circumstances of a place, or the perception of crime in the case of the Elisa Lam case, because I don't want to give too much away here if people haven't seen the show, but there is a little bit of a twist there as to what happened to her. So I've been doing this for so long, I felt like, you know, this would be an interesting way in and to shake it up a little bit, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you certainly did that. I was talking to a filmmaker who's also American, who made The Keepers on Netflix, and he's a new documentary I'd call The Assassins, all about these two young women who were shown on CCTV footage assassinating Kim Jong-un's half-brother. It's called Assassins. It was out here last week. And one of the spine-tingling moments of it is that you see them on CCTV footage committing this act in an airport. And even though your documentary has nothing to do with that whatsoever, there is, without giving a spoiler, 4 minutes of CCTV footage that are spine-tingling as well, relating to Elisa in your, I was going to call it movie, but in your four-parter about her. Do you think, like, CCTV footage, when you found that, like, is that almost like the linchpin on which the movie or the TV show hangs for you? Because it's really eerie, and I was watching it late the other night.
Yeah, it's really spooky. Remember, you know, when I saw that footage in 2013, when it first came out, I remember being, you know, really freaked out about it. I didn't necessarily dig into it and think I'd make a film about it, but circumstances were such that a journalist brought me this story years later, about a year and a half ago, to look into. And because I remembered that impact that that footage had on me, you know, it just felt like, I mean, that footage is the reason that all these internet sleuths, you know, these armchair detectives or internet detectives, you know, amateur detectives decided to start digging into the case to find an answer. So that footage is creepy, interesting, and it went viral. And that's what brought all these people in to try to solve the case. And in doing so, all of these internet sleuths, you know, went down these various rabbit holes of conspiracy theory. And that's what, to me, makes the story so interesting.
What I was also fascinated about was LA is this, like, even for Irish people growing up, you know, we grew up, the people we loved on TV screens and musicians like Guns N' Roses and whoever, you know, they came out of LA. That was the scene. That seemed like the coolest place in the world. And the Cecil Hotel is right in a part of town that people may not be aware of called Skid Row. I mean, it's shocking the degradation that seems to be taking place there, because it just seems to be this open sore of devastation and homeless people and addiction. Were you aware of that before you started looking at this, or did you just start looking at this story and go, what the hell is this?
No, you know, I'm a frequent visitor to Los Angeles, and I think it's shameful what has happened in downtown Los Angeles over the years. And that's one of the things that the documentary series highlights. And one of the reasons I think this new approach of focusing on an area and not just a crime, kind of, you know, in my own way, I feel elevates the genre a little bit, because I think it's important. Anytime you do a true crime story, you don't want to just talk about the misery of somebody's tragedy, but you want to pull back a little bit and give some social commentary. And for me, the social commentary in this documentary, you know, there's a couple of things going on, but one in particular is, you know, how Los Angeles and American society, but Los Angeles in particular, has dealt with mental illness, how we've dealt with homelessness, the fact that downtown LA, you know, most people, especially Europeans, you know, or in the UK, the city's downtown area is usually a vibrant, you know, business district, you know, and is the center of town. There is obviously lots of business that goes down in downtown LA, but it's not where people gravitate towards. And in the early, you know, in the 1920s, when the Hotel Cecil was first built, downtown LA was the center of the universe. And over the decades, it fell into disrepair. And then this Skid Row area was just kind of sprung up and still to this day exists, because Los Angeles had terrible policies. You know, people with mental health issues were let out of institutions and brought to Skid Row kind of to fend for themselves. Mm. People, you know, there's a huge homelessness problem. And it's a shockingly large area that has not been addressed. In fact, the problem is worse than ever.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned about a twist in the documentary, and there certainly is one, and fascinating one. At the same time, I was thinking, you know, when I was halfway through this documentary, I can just go on Google and find out what happened to Elisa, because it was a big deal at the time, certainly in the States, not that it made as much weather over here. Is that a problem in the modern age of documentary making, that everything, whether it's your movies or Making a Murderer or whatever, that everything's a click away, and a person can spoil their own watching, you know, within seconds, within the click of a button?
It is a challenge, and it's particularly in this story, is how do you tell the story in a compelling way that serves both audiences? Both audiences mean the people who know, because this was in fact, that footage we talked about a few minutes ago, that went viral, and millions of people have seen it already. You know, so how do you serve the audience that's never seen it or hasn't heard of the story, versus how do you serve the audience that knows the story? And I think, what, you know, the way it's structured, I think if you don't know the story, everything is a interesting surprise, hopefully, if you like the show, as the series unfolds. And because I took an unusual approach with this story, you know, added to what you just said about people knowing it, in addition to that, at least in the United States, this story has also been the subject of other documentaries about the case.
Okay.
But, and this is to answer the question, all of the other versions of telling this story have leaned into the paranormal, the supernatural, have given too much credence to what I think are just conspiracy theories. And so my approach to the story was to you know, demystify and to pop a, you know, pop the balloon of some of these conspiracy theories. So if you're somebody who's familiar with the story, I think it's still an interesting journey, because what you think you know, and even some of the stuff you would read online, you know, I kind of pick apart and give a give a fresh perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was in no way to do the documentary a disservice, because it's,
oh, no, no,
it's
yeah.
a riveting piece of yeah. a watch. And yeah. mercifully short as well. Like, it's four episodes. And I, not that I wouldn't have wanted longer, but to my mind, there are too many documentaries that go on for too long. But anyway, that's another
thing. I agree with you. It is, you know, four episodes is the perfect binge. You know, after four, it gets rough. And
yeah. Well, you know. Yours never got rough. It was clean shaven. Listen, I spoke to you 2 years ago, Joe, for the Ted Bundy movie, Extremely Evil. And I was about to ask you about Metallica, and a nice English lady came on the line and said, "Sorry, John, you'll have to wrap now," which I did, because I'm a nice guy. And I'm really worried that might happen again. So... the reason why I'm so keen to talk to you about the Metallica documentary, well, it's two things. Firstly, I think on some level you might owe me a retainer for the DVD sales of that in Ireland, because I have told anyone who listened to me just what a brilliant documentary that is. For people who even claim to hate heavy metal, it's fantastic. So I just want to know, one, how you got involved in that, and two, how they kind of agreed to let so much be filmed about them, in essence, being in therapy.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you. I'll send a check via, or I can pay you via Venmo or PayPal.
Yeah, it's a lot easier now. It's great. I'm glad I waited two years.
I'll Venmo you your commission, so I appreciate it. And secondly, you know, the whole reason that film happened, the whole reason the film works, is that it was all a happy accident. We weren't setting out to make that film. In fact, I was basically doing the band a favor, because they wanted to shoot a little promo footage to slap on the back of a CD back in the days when, you know, digital music was, you know, like Napster was just starting to, you know, nip at the heels of the industry. So the record industry at the time was still selling physical CDs, and they wanted to, you know, and to keep those sales going, you know, the conventional wisdom at the time was to slap on a little featurette onto the CD or give some bonus material. And so the whole reason I was out there filming was just to go into the studio, go behind the scenes, slap a little, you know, put together a little 20-minute piece as a favor to them, because they gave me music for the Paradise Lost series, you know, which was the previous set of films that Bruce Sinofsky and I made about a triple homicide in Arkansas. Yeah. One of the guys loved Metallica, and so we wanted to use Metallica music in the film, and they were gracious enough to allow that to happen. So I, you know, and I landed in San Francisco on this assignment where I thought I was going to go cover them recording for a couple of days. Lars informed me that, you know, Jason Newsted, the bassist, had quit the band, and you know, this thing may not be happening. And I just kind of pushed my way into the room when I heard you know, they had hired a therapist, and just started. It just was all a happy little accident that somehow worked out. And it's too long a story for this particular moment, but you know, there was lots of ups and downs in the film. You know, there was a time where the film might not have seen the light of day. But you know, at the end of the day, they decided to allow us to keep filming and to allow us to release it. But it never was intended to be that when we started it.
Joe, thanks very much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
John, I really appreciate it. Thanks again. And cheers. thanks for helping the Metallica sales.
No problem. Checks in the post. Thanks a lot. Yes, the great Joel Berlinger there talking to me about, well, Metallica as well, but all sorts of other things, and primarily his documentary, Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel, which is on Netflix as of this week. And it's a four-parter, mercifully short, as I said, and well worth a watch. Up next, Mark Ryle on the week's new releases.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's new releases, which this week include Tom Hanks' first proper Western with News of the World, which is on Netflix from Wednesday of this week, as in the 10th of February, if I'm not mistaken. And then also a much talked about, or reasonably talked about, movie called Promising Young Woman. I'm joined this week, as I am by just about every week. He was away last week, forest bathing. Mark Ryle, how are you?
I'm grand, John. How's it going?
Good. You got the twigs out of your hair and all that.
I was actually in Dubai. I was doing a bit of influencing.
Very good. You're quarantining at home now, obviously.
Yeah, you know. I have an exemption. My influencing work is essential.
Very good. Very good. Yeah. Okay, listen. So I said Tom Hanks's first Western, if you don't count Woody in Toy Story. Yeah, what's going on in News of the World?
Paul Greengrass's first Western as well. He's back. Tom Hanks is back with Captain Phillips director Paul Greengrass. It is set in Texas in 1870, and when the railroads were taming the Wild West. And Hanks plays Captain Jefferson Kidd. He is an ex-Confederate Army man who makes a meager living going from town to town, reading the newspapers aloud to paying crowds. And then he comes across a non-speaking eight-year-old girl who was, first she was orphaned and kidnapped by Native Americans, and then she's been orphaned a second time when the Kiowa tribe that had taken her in is massacred by white settlers. And in the absence of an alternative, Hanks undertakes the task of bringing the child to her sole surviving relatives, who I think are around 400 miles away, which is not an insignificant journey.
Yeah, it's a journey that becomes quite perilous through the badlands of Texas, so to speak. And his job is very amusing in a way, because he's literally going from town to town reading the news and reading quirky news to take people off their depressing lives of crops not working out and all that kind of thing. And it's still very much, I've obviously seen this as well, hence I'm banging on about it, but it's also very much taking place not long after the Civil War.
Yeah.
What did you make of it?
I think it's a weird one. It's Greengrass's first Western. I mean, it is nicely shot and the landscape is very pretty, but really there's nothing exceptional or remarkable about it. I think probably the most remarkable thing is that Greengrass has ditched his shaky cam style that he trademarked with stuff like United 93 and the Bourne movies. Obviously, because that would not fit this period Western. He is really, really good at choosing action. And one of the first set pieces is impressive. It's nicely tense in a sort of an under 12s accompanied sense. But then after that first set piece, it becomes very episodic. And for me, that did not work. It's very much this bit, then this bit. And I think the pacing is also a bit on the slow side. What did you think?
I really enjoyed it. I was thinking maybe I haven't seen a Western in a long time, sat down to watch one, and I forgot the appeal of so many Westerns is that it's like almost unburdened by cars and buildings and airplanes, and do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's often a very straight story. I enjoyed it because, and maybe it's my daddy issues, but I just adore Tom Hanks playing a role like this. I think a bit like his role in Captain Phillips, that world-weary kind of guy, getting over his own pain in the Civil War, mm-hmm. and his relationship with the girl, the young girl, who's a German actress.
Helene Zengel.
Yeah, I really liked. It was slow and there wasn't a huge amount of wild action scenes or action scenes generally, but you know, it kind of worked for me as a character study of two lost souls in kind of Western America or Western set America. So, I mean, as I always say, like Giles and Dunphy, we spoke earlier in the week. And when you told me what you thought of it, I didn't think I was going to enjoy it. But then when I watched it, I was surprised by how much I enjoyed it, actually.
That's fair enough. I think it reminded me of the Saving Private Ryan. I can't remember what the character played in that, but there's a lot of, you know, trauma through shaking hands. I think there's a on the level talking about the relationship between the two. There's a difference between an actor and a movie star. And Hanks is definitely a movie star. He is unquestionably this generation's Jimmy Stewart. And of course, as ever, he is faultless and his charisma is impeccable. But I think here, Hanks, the movie star, is being used to paper over a lack of character development. And Helena Zengel, the girl, the actor who's playing the girl, she's got a very, very striking presence for such a young actor. And her character, Joanna, she does a lot of shrieking, but she is near mute. And I think she and Hanks make for a very unlikely pairing. And for me, the script really struggles to get past her inability to communicate. And there's not so much of a connection between them, despite the script really desperately trying to suggest that there is. And the relationship moves from A to C to E without passing through B or D. And I think there's an awful lot of inorganic skipping forward. And it's because of this lack of a connection that the story is never as emotionally engaging as it seems to think it is, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I can see what you're saying. And that's one of the things of the movies. They're using weird different types of languages. At one point, they're talking in German. They're talking in Native American. He's trying to teach her English and all that kind of stuff. But again, that I keep saying that worked for me. Like I'm in some bad 90s movie with Stephen Fry. But it did. I kind of found an emotional way to it. But I think we're probably just, unfortunately, on this one, or, you know, it's the point of discussing these things, but we're on slightly different pages with it. But I do get what you're saying, that maybe sometimes Tom Hanks as a movie star, maybe you're not saying this, but it occurs to me Tom Hanks the movie star maybe gets in the way of Tom Hanks the actor, in the way that that happens with James Stewart. You know, there's James Stewart.
I think it's more the Tom Hanks the movie star is being used to as shorthand for like a lack of, you know, a connection between the pair in on the written page.
Yeah, why wouldn't anyone just want to be in a movie with Tom Hanks? So
why indeed.
Yeah. Okay, so what are you going to say stars-wise?
I'm going to give it 2.5. I think it's fine, but nothing more. And I don't think it really, really rises above the average.
Okay. I'm going to give it 3.5 because I think it does rise slightly above the average. That said, I did realize that I was really missing seeing a good old-fashioned Western, which I thought this had elements of. So this has been out since Wednesday. So do let us know if you might have watched the News of the World with Tom Hanks. You can text us on 53106. You can email us screentime@newstalk.com. Or, of course, you can tweet me, John_Fardy. Now, let's take a clip of News of the World.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Captain Jefferson Kyle Kidd, and I'm here tonight to read the news from across this great world of ours.
So they pay you to tell stories.
I ain't never heard of that as a thing a man can do.
Well, it's not a rich man's occupation, as you can see. Do you understand English?
Oh, yeah, I call that,
friend. Says your name is Johanna Leonberger. Indians took you when they attacked your family 6 years prior. Your mother, father, and sister were, well, they passed. She's got family down in Castroville.
Captain, why are you doing this?
She needs to laugh and dream. She needs new memories.
A clip of News of the World there, which I gave 3.5 to, and Mark gave 2.5 to. Now, Mark, we turn to Promising Young Woman. This movie's created a bit of controversy. Tell us what's going on here.
This, I think, was screened back in Sundance of last year, so it has been hanging around a while now, as have many things. It's a movie that's really hard to pin down. It is many things. It's a black comedy. It's a revenge thriller. It's almost a romantic comedy, and then it kind of flirts with elements of horror as well. The story is Kerry Mulligan is Cassie. She's a 30-year-old med school dropout. She's working a dead-end coffee shop job by day, and she spends her nights in bars and nightclubs pretending to be blackout drunk to honey trap creepy guys into taking her home and taking advantage of her comatose state. And this plays out the same nearly every time. The guy says, it's okay, you're safe, don't worry, I'm a nice guy. And then he tries to have sex with her, at which point Cassie switches off the drunk act and watches the quote-unquote nice guy squirm.
Yeah, and you're right about the various styles. You're kind of scratching your head saying, you know, what is this? Sometimes it was like an almost zany, slightly quirky rom-com.
Yeah.
I had the feeling of that, like you say. And then at other times, it's clearly a very serious endeavor. And, you know, Cassie's character is trying to get over or certainly revenge some aspect of her past. So it really pulls you in different ways. Did you, you know, it seems like a strange question to ask about something that on the surface is such a heavy movie. Did you enjoy it?
Did you like it? I loved it. It's brilliant. As the backstory unfolds, we discover that Cassie has a deeply personal reason for carrying out this vendetta. And also, as the backstory unfolds, the title becomes incredibly important, because who is the promising young woman? I mean, on the face of it, it's not Cassie, because she's 30 years old. She's a college dropout. She's still living at home with her parents. But then if it is Cassie, what happened to the promising young woman? It's extraordinary to think that this is the first movie that Emerald Fennell has written and directed, because she's really achieved something extraordinary here. Tonally, as I said, it's a bit of a mixed bag, and it changes lanes so many times that it becomes unsettling. The last act, which I'm obviously not going to talk about in depth, but it steers a bit too close to melodrama for me, and it felt very out of place with what came before it. But it really does get very, very dark, I think it's safe to say.
It certainly does. It certainly does. And, you know, this garnered some controversy because Kerry Mulligan was really displeased about a review in Variety that seemed to intimate that she wasn't the right character to play a femme fatale.
Yeah.
She took exception to that. Now, I think she was right. The subsequent critic has come out saying that's not what I said. But I suppose there's controversy as well about this movie that, you know, some people are saying it's just crude revenge porn. Other people are saying it's a work of feminist glory. I agree with you, though, that it's a great film, irrespective of what you want to call it. Mm. I really liked that way it played with the style of it. Like, it did it purposefully, so it wasn't just being, were this thing one stage, were this thing another stage. It was doing that on purpose, almost to make a point about, you know, life or something, that it can be all shapes and sizes. So I really enjoyed it as well.
Yeah.
What would you say stars wise?
Oh wow, we're here already. I'm going to give it a 4. I think I was going to maybe give it 3.5 because of the melodramatic ending, but it's such a brilliant piece of work. I think it's an easy 4 for me.
Now, you said, oh, we're there already.
Oh,
wow, you had more to say, so please tell me.
I have so much more to say. No, just going back on the review, I did read it, and I think that is actually what the critic was intimating. And I think, like, for me, by all means, go after the performance, but don't go near somebody's, you know, appearance. That's not something that's done. And just on Carrie Mulligan, she's absolutely tremendous. She's mercurial.
Brilliant.
And comedian-like, and Cassie, it's a fascinating character. She's a fully written, lived-in character, and one of the best that I've seen in recent memory. And just, like, to sum up, it's a movie that really does dump some difficult questions into your lap, and it presents us with some uncomfortable and inconvenient scenarios. And I think what it does really well is it shows us the ripple effects of trauma and how, you know, a single act can destroy many lives. And ultimately what she's doing, she's looking for retribution and justice, and she's trying to fix something that can't be fixed. And yet morally and ethically, it's on shaky ground, but it's immensely satisfying to sit back and watch it nevertheless, you know.
Immensely. And I put this on late one night, and I was thinking, oh, I'll finish it in the morning. But I stayed with it the whole way through. Yeah. No, I thought it was a great piece of work. I'm also going to give it 4 stars. And we should say that is available on all sorts of video on demand platforms from this Friday, the 12th of February. Mark, great to have you back. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
Mark Ryle there talking to me about The Great Promising Young Woman, a fine, intriguing film. And also News of the World with Tom Hanks on Netflix, which I really enjoyed. Well, I greatly enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. I gave it 3.5 stars. Mark was less impressed. Do let me know if you might have seen it, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. Up next, Lord Mayor of Dublin, Hazel Chu, on her favourite movie. Yes, you're listening to Screen Time here on News Talk, the weekly TV and movie show with me, John Fardy. It's that stage of the week where I talk to someone well-known about their favourite movie. I'm delighted now to be joined by the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Hazel Chu.
Hi, John. How's it going? Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Now, I was saying to you before we came on, someone sent me an email this week detailing what your favorite movie was, and I nearly fell out of my chair, and I don't really know why. It's not like I thought that much about what your favorite movie would be, but maybe tell our listeners what your favorite film is.
I'm actually quite surprised. You're not the first one to say this, because whenever I mention my favorite movie or favorite book, everyone just kind of gives me a raised eyebrow. So my favorite movie is Top Gun.
Wow. Explain why.
Well, it's a great action movie. It has everything I need in an action movie, in that it has an action, drama, danger, and speed. And also, I really like planes. And I guess once upon a time, I thought, if being a fighter pilot wouldn't be bad. And I like that adrenaline rush. And believe it or not, I actually really liked a lot of the movies Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer produced. So I think for me, I'm a bit of a kind of action head insofar I like nice. Movies that I don't have to focus too much on, or if I had to focus, it'd be like, oh, that's great kind of way. So,
and so, you know, the obvious thing, you probably would have seen that when you were considerably younger, not that you're old by any stretch of the imagination, but were you in love with Tom Cruise?
God, no. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I think everyone says that to me, is it because of Tom Cruise? And they're going, no, like, I don't like, actually, I found Val Kilmer kind of cooler in the movie, if we're saying who I was fancying more. But I think for me, it was more the planes. So I would look at the F-14s and go, ooh, that's like amazing. So, and my other half finds this really odd, because he loves he loves more kind of dramas and arty movies, and I like action movies. So
are you a big plane head? You're into like planes?
Not a massive plane head. It was something to do with, and this is the thing, I guess my stance, especially in politics, is that I wouldn't necessarily be too pro-military either. Yeah. And I wouldn't be a big kind of plane head, but it was just how it all formed together. And I think also there was this sense of I'm quite competitive, so there was this whole competition and fighting for a trophy, but also camaraderie, and there was the sadness as well of Goose dying. So it was like, oh, it was everything I needed in an hour and a half, I think it is. So, and you can't beat Kenny Loggins for a really cheesy but good tune as well. So Danger Zone was something I would constantly be humming or singing through the years.
The Danger Zone, Into the Danger Zone, is a good song, there's no doubting it. And spoiler alert, Goose dies, just in case anyone hasn't seen the movie.
I'm so sorry, everyone.
All right. You're the mayor, you get away with that stuff. And tell me this, are movies a big part of your downtime, either now or in the past?
In the past, yeah, I would have really liked going to my local cinema. So my local cinema was the Swan. And even when I was young, my favorite thing coming when I was in Selbridge would be getting the bus out to Easton's, meeting my friends under the clock, and then going to Savoy. And it would have been something, I think when I was younger, it was a treat, and it was something to meet my friends with and enjoying the latest kind of movie. And then as I got a bit older, it was just downtime, as you call it. So it was just being able to, like, the best trips were when a good few of us got together for like a movie event. So Star Wars, when we were the previous years of Star Wars coming out, even though we hadn't seen each other in a while and we wouldn't be hanging out every weekend, there was about 15 of us that block booked to go to see Star Wars. And I got my friend's lightsaber to go along, and it was just fun. It was good crack. So,
wow. An image of you with a lightsaber marching to the Savoy. We're learning loads about you.
Well, my favorite movie is also Lord of the Rings, so that would give you some insight as well. Yeah. But I think for movie wise, the reason I picked Top Gun, there's other movies I love during the year, but I think Top Gun, I've watched it, gotta be at least 50 times at this stage, and wow, probably more. And it's one of those that if I was cleaning the house and I want something in the background, I would have put on in the background. If I was coming home during the days when I lived with flatmates, we would go home and put on something, and that would be the something I put on. It actually got to the stage where they rolled their eyes at me quite often whenever I say, hey, let's put this on. So it's good fun, and it's good memories, and it's why I love it. So
great. Well, thank you for sharing that. Listen, we don't do politics on this show because it's a film show, but I just want to ask you a couple of things about being Lord Mayor, if I might. Is it strange being the mayor in the time of COVID, when normally a mayor, you know, a large part of it is being out and about? I presume that's been curtailed a bit.
It has, massively so, actually. And the problem is, this role, as you said, you've always been out and about, you've always been meeting people and outreach and talking to people, and there's a lot of ceremonial stuff happening. So there would have been events in this house at least 3 times a day. So the Oak Room, which is a beautiful room, would have hosted different organizations at least once a day, over, so 6 events a week at least in there. And then I would have been going out to the community, to businesses, opening certain stuff. And that all went, mainly because it just could not be done during a pandemic. So I was very conscious at the beginning, what can I do? And what I could do was represent the people that I'm here for, which is people of Dublin, people of Ireland as well, but people of Dublin mainly, because Dublin's my remit. So I sat down with the executive, and we had a good conversation about my priorities for the year, which was homeless and housing, discrimination, fighting discrimination, and making sure we had a sustainable city to live in. And lo and behold, the executive were very supportive. I think for them, having a Lord Mayor that actually had the time and the space and the background to support was important to them. So we've been working. I set up a homeless task force. I just kicked off an integration strategy for the city to start working on it. And then we have had a range of COVID mobility measures as well. So it's been a different year. I'm very conscious, again, still about the outreach. So one of the things I've asked the team to do here is we're going to set up a series of what I call lunchtime chats. So I will be every Friday, starting in 2 weeks' time, having a conversation with someone, sometimes within the council, like the chief executive, or within the external space, like night culture representatives. And that will be live, and it will be talking to these people, asking them questions and allowing the public to ask them and me questions as well. So we're going to kick that off and at least be able to hit that kind of engagement piece as well.
Great. And listen, finally then, I don't want to give any oxygen to some of the awful racist stuff that we've heard about in relation to you in the office, because I said I don't do politics on the show. I certainly don't do that. But in happier news, as I'm talking to you, this weekend begins the Chinese New Year. And I'm wondering, is it important for you? Is it important for the city that you are the one who happens to be Lord Mayor this time in Dublin? I think it probably is, right?
I think this is a hard question without sounding ultra arrogant. That's the thing. Well, is it important? Let's rephrase it, I guess. Is it important to have someone different while in the role of these times, especially these divided times? Absolutely, I think. And if it wasn't me, it should be someone else, mainly because we do need more diversity. We need more of everyone at the table. That's where you come to good governing and good policies for everyone, because it's not a one size fits all. And also, it's to talk about how differences are to be celebrated, because we've just gone through 4 years of a man who claimed to be the leader, or who was the leader of a very big country, went on Twitter every day to incite hate, and that does not help bode for unity. And when you have those divisions, and those divisions did come in the form of Capitol Hill, it makes me worry that if we don't do unity and don't try to work together more and don't celebrate people's differences, that is the route you end up going down. And no one wants that and no one needs that. So I think it is really important we celebrate diversity. It's important to have people from all backgrounds in different roles, in the Oireachtas, in here, in the Lord Mayor's office, on the council level, everywhere. So
great. Well, very well said. Well, her favorite movie is Top Gun. Lord Mayor of Dublin, Hazel Chew, it has been a revelation to talk to you. And I guess it's okay if I wish you a happy new year.
A happy new year to you too, or Gung Hei Fa Choi, as we say in Cantonese.
Now, we don't make policy here, gentlemen. Elected officials, civilians do that. We are the instruments of that policy. And although we're not at war, we must always act as though we are at war.
What are you doing?
Tip the spear.
Just wondering.
Best be sure.
Who's the best?
In case some of you wonder who the best is, they're up here on this plaque on the wall. The best driver in Israel from each class has his name on it. And they have the option to come back here to be Top Gun instructors. You think your name's gonna be on that plaque?
Yes, sir.
That's pretty arrogant, considering the company you're in.
Yes, sir.
I like that in a pilot.
A clip there from Top Gun. What else? And that was the favorite movie choice of the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Hazel Chew. And my thanks to her. That's it for this week. Next week on the show, I'll be talking to Hugh Bonneville, All Going to Plan. He of... well, all sorts of fame, but the dad in Downton Abbey, and also Eve Hewson on a new Netflix series. I was meant to be talking to Michael Imperioli of The Sopranos fame. We're still going to do that. It just got moved around slightly, but that is coming. Don't you worry, kiddies. That's it for this week. My thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show. Just to remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app, or wherever you choose to get your podcast. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. Just want to remind you that you can get in contact with me or the show all week long by emailing screentime@newstalk.com, or you can tweet me. My Twitter handle is John_Fardy. Leave you with some love music from the movies for the weekend that's in it. An Officer and a Gentleman. We will play out with Joe Cocker and Jennifer Warnes, Up Where We Belong. Have a great and a romantic weekend.
Who knows what tomorrow brings? In a world few hearts survive.
All I know is the way I feel when it's real. Keep it alive. The road is long. There are mountains in our way, but we climb the stair every day. The lift is up where we belong. Every day.